Welcome to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 in Santa Barbara. My name is Damon Azali, and I'm here with my co-host, Eric Mann, and this is Voices from the Frontline segment of the 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour. Today, fresh off the plane from the Boston Social Forum and the Democratic National Convention, we'll have Eric Mann sharing some of his thoughts about the happenings in Boston. But first, we're going to have a speech also delivered at the Boston Social Forum by Manning Marable, and he's going to be talking about anti-racism within the anti-globalization movement and fighting the three big hitters, unemployment, mass incarceration, and disenfranchisement. And finally, we're going to be speaking to Waliah Johns, the director of the Black Mesa Water Coalition, that is trying to stop the use of their groundwater in coal mining operations and how they're trying to build a more sustainable future for Black Mesa Dene Reservation in northeastern Arizona. So first we're going to have Eric. Welcome, Eric.
Hey, welcome, Damon. It's good to be back. Hey, the studios, thank you for all that when you contribute to KPFK. I mean, this is beautiful. We have new equipment. We have JBL speakers, stuff that's supposed to be good for you to hear out there, so hopefully the quality is good for you. It's nice to work in such beautiful new studios. So we're going to move right away with no introduction to Manning Marable.
I have been under strict guidelines about how much time we have. We want to have a Q&A, and so I will be uncharacteristically brief. I'm going to stick to the text. What I've been asked to talk about today was how to build capacities on the ground that make the anti-globalization real within the United States, and how do we link the struggles here with the struggles that are occurring throughout the world. As I looked at the audience and as I began to do what speakers normally do before you go up to the podium, because you never have as much time as you had initially planned, and you start doing surgery on your own text, I began to privilege more so the anti-racist component and cut out more and more the tactical and the instrumentalist elements within my proposal, because I think it's important, looking at the people who have come here today and this weekend, that we are in a city that does have substantial West Indian, substantial African American and Latino population. We're in the Northeast, where there are substantial communities of color, and though they aren't adequately represented, and we have to be quite frank, they're not adequately represented here. And so it's important for the anti-globalization movement, when we talk about developing strategies or methods of resistance, to talk about you build capacities from below around things and struggles that people see every day. And you build from the struggles that are already occurring in daily life. We don't have to reinvent the social justice wheel, because that wheel is turning every day. The question is not so much how we can teach those who are oppressed in the United States to understand or have a clearer vision of the internationalist links that impact their daily oppression, but rather how we can learn from those who struggle on the ground every day. It is for us to learn the processes of resistance that are being waged around us every day and extrapolate from those processes so that we can indeed think locally and act locally, but also act and think globally as well. In 1900, the great African-American scholar W.E.B. Du Bois predicted that, quote, the problem of the 20th century would be the problem of the color line. the unequal relationship between the lighter versus the darker races of humankind on the planet. Now, although Dr. Du Bois was primarily focused on the racial contradiction of the United States, he was fully aware that these processes of what today scholars call racialization, the construction of racial hierarchies, of inequality between dominant and subordinate social relations, between groups, this is an international, transnational, or global problem. It is a global problem. And Du Bois understood that when he wrote that sentence in August of 1900. Du Bois's color line included not just the racially segregated Jim Crow South and the racial oppression of South Africa, but it also included the British, the French, the Belgians, the Portuguese, the colonial regimes that existed in Latin America, in Asia, in Africa, in the Caribbean. It also included the struggles of indigenous populations all over the world. Building on Du Bois's insight, I would say that the most important theoretical insight that the anti-globalization movement in the United States needs to start from is that the problem of the 21st century is the problem of global apartheid or global apartheid. That is, the racialized division and stratification of resources, of wealth and power that separates Western Europe, North America, and Japan from the billions of mostly brown, black, indigenous, undocumented immigrants, and poor folk across this planet. It is global apartheid that is fundamentally the contradiction that we have to struggle against, and we cannot half-step this. If our vision, if the vision of the anti-globalization movement doesn't have at its core a vision that challenges and is committed, root and branch, to the dismantling of global apartheid, it will never be successful, nor should it be successful, nor should it be, because the misery and the pain and the billions of human beings whose lives are being crushed by predatory capitalism operates inextricably, as I will try to prove in the next 15 minutes, around the structure of global apartheid. Now, the term apartheid, as most of you know, comes from the former white minority regime of South Africa. It is an Afrikaans word that means apartness or separation. Apartheid was based on the concept of what the in Afrikaans they call it herenvolk, master race, which was determined or destined to rule as over the non-Europeans. Now, under global apartheid today, the racist logic of the herenvolk, the master race, still exists, embedded in the patterns, the deep patterns of unequal economic exchange that penalize African, Southern Asian, Caribbean, and poor nations by the predatory policies of structural adjustment, by loan payments to multinational banks, and the whole machinations of crony and corporate capitalism. Inside of the United States, these processes of global apartheid are best represented by what I call in my writing the new racial domain, or the NRD. What is the new racial domain? The new racial domain is different from earlier systems of racial domination and exploitation, such as slavery, Jim Crow segregation, and ghettoization. These earlier forms of white racial supremacy and black and brown exploitation and depression were grounded primarily, but not exclusively, within the political economy of U.S. capitalism, within the domestic economy of the United States, grounded in the private market. The anti-racist oppositional movements that blacks and other people of color and white anti-racists that they built over a period of several centuries, struggling to overturn these systems of racial domination. They came up with models, and they came up with tactical and strategic approaches to challenge and overturn the legitimacy of these structures of racial domination. The reforms, such as the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the 1965 Voting Rights Act. These reforms were debated almost entirely within the context of America's domestic economy and in the light of the 1960s in a context of Keynesian welfare state public policies and an expansive capitalist free market economy. In 1969, black male unemployment for black married males, rather, was only 2.5% in the United States. In 1969, African American unemployment was 7% in 1969. And so in the context of the civil rights movement, what is often forgotten is that the capitalist economy was expanding, that the reforms took place in social democratic and the Keynesian reforms occurred in a context of an expanding pie. The political economy of the new racial domain in the 21st century, by contrast, is driven largely, not exclusively, but largely by the processes of transnational capitalism and by the public policies of what today is called transnationally neoliberalism. From the vantage point of the oppressed in the United States, the new racial domain rests upon what could be called an unholy trinity. What is the unholy trinity? Angela has eloquently spoken to it. The unholy trinity of the new racial domain is mass unemployment, mass incarceration, and mass disenfranchisement. All three of these elements are central to the structure, the new structure of racialized domination in the 21st century. And they represent qualitatively, and I know some Marxists don't like to say this, but qualitatively sometimes there is new stuff that does occur. This is new. This is new. Qualitatively, this is new. Now, what is the new thing? The process begins at the point of production. For decades, U.S. corporations have been outsourcing millions of better-paying jobs outside of the country. The class warfare against unions has led to a steady decline over the last 50 years of the percentage of American working people inside of unions, from something like 38% at the end of World War II to barely 13 or 12% today. In some states like South Carolina, only 3% of the labor force is unionized in that state. 3%. Within the whole U.S. urban neighborhoods, losing virtually their entire manufacturing and industrial employment, and with neoliberal social policies in place, cutting job training programs, welfare, public housing, millions of Americans now exist in conditions that exceed the devastation of the Great Depression during the 1930s. In 2004, New York's Central Harlem community, 50% of black adults are currently unemployed. 50%. That's not Manning, Marable. That's the New York Urban League statistic. So you're talking about half of the adult population that is not gainfully employed in central Harlem. Nationwide, there was a recent report that just came out in the New York Times. I have to go through this a little more quickly. I'm running out of time. That pointed out that in the year 2002, one-fourth of all black male adults were unemployed throughout the entire year of 2004. A fourth of the male population in the black community was unemployed for the entire year. And so when you look at the impact of structural unemployment upon the community, you're talking about millions of people who have never had a job at a wage that can support a family for their entire adult, for their entire lives. You're talking about essentially unemployment and underemployment, that is, working at a part-time job when people want full-time work, is the norm, and people with employment is abnormal. Is abnormal. Neoliberal social policies adopted and implemented by Democrats and Republicans alike have compounded the problem. So in 1996, with the Welfare Act, the social safety net was largely pulled apart. By 2004, in January, the number of households on public assistance had dropped to 2 million from 5 million families on welfare in 1995. New regulations and restrictions intimidated hundreds of thousands of poor people from even requesting public assistance. Mass unemployment inevitably leads to mass incarceration. About a third of all prisoners were unemployed at the time of their arrest. Others averaged less than $15,000 annual income in the year prior to their arrest. You have in New York State 71,000 women and men currently in its prisons. As Angela pointed out, 2.1, 2.2 million people incarcerated in the United States today. Parole has been made much more restrictive as well. And in 1995, Pell Grant subsidies supporting educational programs for prisoners were ended. For those fortunate enough to successfully navigate the criminal justice bureaucracy and emerge from incarceration, they discovered that both the federal and the state governments explicitly prohibit the employment of convicted ex-felons in literally hundreds of jobs. The cycle of unemployment starts again. Mass incarceration, of course, breeds mass political disenfranchisement. And again, Angela spoke to this. I just want to be very brief. In 7 states, former prisoners convicted of a felony lose their voting rights for life. For life. In the majority of states, individuals on parole and probation cannot vote. About 15% of all African-American males nationwide are either permanently or currently disenfranchised. In Mississippi, a third of all black men cannot vote for the remainder of their lives. Now, this is very significant because 40 years ago, as some of the activists in this room know, people went down to Mississippi for what was called Freedom Summer. People gave their lives. Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney fought to win what? The right to vote. That right in Mississippi has been taken away from us. We have to win it back. We have to win it back. And the language of resistance that links the struggle for the franchise must be central to the articulation of a politics of anti-racist, anti-globalization. There is a relationship between what is occurring in Africa and Asia and Latin America and the Caribbean in terms of the predatory impact of capitalism and the disenfranchisement that we see in Mississippi. And if anti-globalization, 2 minutes, I can't believe it. All right. I've got to jump ahead. I keep cutting stuff. All right, you're really going to get lightweight on the prescriptive piece. How do we build resistance in the new racial domain, in the age of globalized capitalism? Well, it should surprise no one that the resistance is already occurring on the ground in thousands and thousands of venues, in local neighborhoods, people fighting against police brutality, against mandatory minimum sentencing laws, for prisoners' rights, in the fight for a living wage, to expand unionization and workers' rights, in the struggles of working women for daycare, for their children, for health care, for public transportation, for quality and decent housing. These practical struggles of daily life are really the core of what constitutes day-to-day resistance. Building capacities of hope and resistance on the ground develops our ability to challenge the system in more fundamental, direct ways. The recently successful immigrant worker freedom rides highlights the plight of undocumented working people who enter the U.S., represent an excellent model that links the oppressive situation of new immigrants who struggle and come to this country searching for a better economic way of life with the struggle of black women and men 40 years ago to challenge Jim Crow segregation. Many sincere white anti-globalization activists need to learn more closely from the historic black freedom movement and successful models of resistance, from selective buying campaigns, economic boycotts, rent strikes, civil disobedience, which the movement helped to establish in this country. You are not reinventing or inventing models, rather, of social justice activism and resistance. Others have come before you. Others have come before you. The task, therefore, is to learn something of the fabric of the history of this country, and people of color who fought for democracy in this country, in order for us to imagine a world where democracy is transnational and global for all. I have to stop, but I have to stop with a 30-second story. So I'm just going to go nuts with the time. As some of you know, I lecture on a regular basis in Sing Sing Prison in Ossining, New York. They have a big sign over the penitentiary that says, it's in yellow with red writing, and it says, "Through these doors pass the finest corrections officers in the world." And it reminded me when I first saw it, when I went in, and they just put it up a couple years ago, of the sign over Auschwitz, right? "Work makes us free." Both obscenities. I asked Reverend Bill Weber, who teaches in the master's degree program for prisoners, what he thought of the sign. He had one word to say. He said, "It's demonic." And Bill was right. But I asked a young brother, a Latino man named Tony, 35-year-old brother who was in prison for the next 20 years, and he said, "Yeah, that's right, Manny, it is demonic, but perhaps it is time to face the demon head on." And so when we map strategies of resistance, remember the 2 million women and men in prison in the United States. Remember the 5.5 million Americans who have lost the right to vote for life. For life. Remember the 25% to 50% of brown and black folk who are unemployed in this country. And remember, it is time to face the demon head on. Thank you.